All right, how do you know the housing market is recovering and the economy is doing all right? Homelessness is up. A story from the streets of LA today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 28th day of May. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We are going to start off today with telecommunications. First, a dose of policy, and then a dash of real life for you. The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, a guy by the name of Tom Wheeler, is floating a plan that could help narrow the digital divide in this country. That thing where low-income Americans often fall behind in the biggest economy in the world because they can't get online. Wheeler wants to retool a $1.6 billion subsidy program called Lifeline that at present is used to help pay phone bills. He wants to let the money be used for internet bills instead. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has the details.
When Lifeline started some 30 years ago, phones were regarded as something everyone needed. Some say that's just like the internet today.
Broadband is the, we call it the indispensable infrastructure of the 21st century.
Bernadine Jocelyn is with the Blandin Foundation, a philanthropy focused on rural Minnesota. She's glad to see the FCC move to get more folks connected to the internet so they don't fall further behind economically.
Well, you know, you can't even apply for a job these days without using the internet, even jobs where you don't have to use the internet on the job.
The Lifeline program has income requirements. Eligible households get a $9.25 credit towards their monthly phone bills. Who pays? The rest of us, through the universal access charge on our phone bills, which subsidizes a few other programs, too. Michael O'Reilly, a Republican FCC commissioner, isn't convinced that's always fair.
Where we're getting the resources for this funding comes from ratepayers, rich and poor, throughout America today.
O'Reilly says Lifeline has had problems with fraud, and he thinks many people would figure out how to pay their phone bills without the program. He says that could also be true if Lifeline expanded to subsidize broadband. But Blair Levin, a former FCC chief of staff who's now at the Brookings Institution, thinks the expansion could really help close the digital divide.
This is a very important step. It's the most important step, but it's not the last step.
Not the last step, because Levin says you can't just help people pay for internet. You also have to teach some how to even use it. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Okay, so now for the real-life bit of today's telecommunications palooza. Maybe this is just me, and in fact, now that I think about it, it probably is. But my guess is that if I say the phrase, now on tap, your mind might first go to the beer menu at your local pub, not the latest and greatest in Google's never-ending quest to be in every aspect of our daily lives. Google, however, would be the right choice. The company announced a whiz-bang version of its Google Now technology at a big conference it held today. It's an improvement on something called contextualized search. Our tech correspondent Molly Wood was there, and we got her on the line for a quick explainer. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, contextualized search. Help me out here. What is that and why does it matter?
So it is the idea that your phone should be able to understand what you're doing, where you are, whether you're driving, what apps you're using, and give you information that you'll need at that exact moment or place. So if you just arrived in San Francisco, maybe you need a restaurant recommendation. But what Google announced today is the ability to do some of that contextual information providing inside an app. So It will know what song you're listening to in a music app. And if you want to tap the home button and ask a question about that song, you don't have to say, you know, what's the real name of the artist Skrillex? That was one example that they gave. Yeah. If you're listening to Skrillex, Google will know that you're listening to Skrillex.
Which is scary, but anyway.
Yeah, no, the whole premise here, Kai, is that Google will know. They'll know what you're doing and anytime you're doing it. But so that in that app, you'd be able to say, what's his name? And the app would know, Google Now would know that you mean Skrillex, and it would give you his name.
Wow. All right, so a whole bunch of questions come out of this. We don't have time for all of them. I'll get the big ones then. What does this mean for Google as a company? Because it's been under some duress.
Yes, absolutely. It's great for Google because it means that Google can follow you around no matter what you're doing. So if you're in an app, you're still potentially using Google services like Search, like Now, maybe Maps. And so it means that they're still with you all the time. And they're gathering more data about you. They're understanding what you do in apps and on Search.
Right. Well, so that gets me to my second question. And it was going to be, how do I get it? But now it's going to be, do I really want it? Because it's a little creepy.
It's definitely a little creepy. It requires you turning over a lot of information, essentially all information, to Google. But it's the kind of thing where if it works as advertised, it could actually make your life easy enough that you kind of want to.
I don't know. Molly Wood, she's our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Yeah, I still don't know. Try though they might have, traders never did better than break even today. Nothing too terrible at the corner of Wall Street and Broad, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Reports out of India are that as many as 1,400 people have died in the heat wave that that country has been having. Temperatures in some cities are well over 120 degrees. The monsoons are on their way, but in the meanwhile, things do still have to get done every day. The BBC's Justin Rowlett is in Delhi. We've got him on the line. Justin, it's good to speak with you again.
Hi, Kai. How are you doing?
I'm well, but how does one, or I guess does one, go about daily life when it's 120-something degrees out? Can you go out and go to markets and go to stalls and cafes and restaurants if that's what you want to do?
I have to say, you can. Delhi, a lot of India at the moment, is very, very dry. And in dry heat, it's much easier to manage these high temperatures. Earlier in the week, I was in Bangladesh. The temperature's not quite as high, but it's incredibly humid there. And actually, that is a lot more uncomfortable. So actually, in Delhi, you know, so long as you're careful, so long as you take it slow, you can kind of get around. But there have been stories like, for example, non-air-conditioned taxis have been told you've got to get off the roads and make sure you get some rest and relaxation. You don't sit in a tin box in the sun for hours and hours, as many taxi drivers want to do in order to kind of make sure that they get the money they need. So, you know, everybody here is being warned, take things easy. You know, don't push it in these terrible heats.
The problem, of course, with people who can't work because of the heat is that they don't get paid, right?
Yeah, there's a huge problem. If they don't work, they don't get paid. And I have to say, that's one of the problems. People push it. They're desperate for the work, so they go out and work, continue to work hard in these terrible heats. And this has claimed a lot of lives. You know, the death toll is now well over 1,000.
What about infrastructure? Are you having power outages? Is there enough water?
There don't seem to have been significant problems. There have been issues, like, for example, some of the roads have melted.
Yeah.
But, there don't seem to be huge issues with power outages. There don't seem to be huge shortages of water. But that might be an issue if this continues. Look, the monsoon's beginning to come into India now, and that should take some of the heat off. We're being told here in Delhi to expect some rain. But they said that a couple of days ago, and it hasn't come yet, Kai. There was a bit of clouding over. It was a bit cooler today. But, you know, what people are waiting for is the great release of the monsoon, which cools temperatures down, increases humidities, but brings the temperatures down, makes things a bit more livable.
Justin Rowlett with the BBC. We got him in Delhi talking about the heat wave they're having over there. Justin, thanks.
Thanks, Kai. Cheers.
Last month, Los Angeles County released the results of its annual census of the homeless population here. And among the many disturbing statistics in that report was this one. The number of people living completely out in the open without any real shelter at all has doubled in just the past 2 years. For decades, the city of L.A., where the overwhelming majority of the population is, has concentrated the homeless and services for them in a downtown neighborhood called Skid Row. Now, though, tents and tent cities are lining freeways. They're filling up underpasses and moving into parks, which means, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, that homelessness in L.A. isn't out of sight, out of mind anymore.
Along the freeway in Hollywood, three outreach workers duck through a hole in a chain-link fence.
Be careful. See those syringes?
On the hillside overlooking the traffic, the team tries to engage with people living in tents.
Hey, you hungry up here, man?
I ask 42-year-old Danny Andrino.
What's the reason behind your homelessness?
Housing. It's too much. I can't afford housing here in L.A.
And what kind of rents are you looking at if you tried to get a place?
$1,000. Minimum wage not covering that.
This is just one of many new encampments that have sprung up across the city. Courtney Kanagi is director of street outreach at PATH, People Assisting the Homeless.
We are seeing them in places that they didn't used to have encampments. We're seeing them under underpasses, sides of freeways, like what we're at today. We're also seeing them come down into neighborhoods and be more on the streets.
Some of the increased visibility is the result of lawsuits. Until the city can supply more affordable housing, the homeless can legally camp on sidewalks from 9 p.m. until 6 a.m. Also, the police are now restricted in the way they deal with people's possessions.
If they take somebody into custody, then law enforcement needs to go ahead, take all of their property, and they need to input it, they need to store it.
Just itemizing all the stuff can take hours. It's not just tents, but piles of belongings. Some of it's basically trash. And the cops don't have a place to store it. For police, those are big incentives to look the other way. As I visit new encampments across the city, many are on state property adjacent to or beneath freeways, which falls outside the jurisdiction of the police. As for why people become homeless, the causes are as varied as human beings. Some struggle with mental health issues. I meet a 50-year-old man playing drums under the freeway in a new encampment south of downtown.
I'm Stephen Taylor. ST stands for Stephen Taylor, Broke Stephen Taylor, which means Broke Street.
When we talk, Taylor couldn't be nicer. But sometimes, he says he will
pop off and get angry. I have a problem with reaction. Well, they say I have bipolar. I have the medication. I'm scared to take it. I've had it for about 3 months. I'm scared to take it, though.
Others are homeless as a result of a transition. Veterans leaving military service. Young adults aging out of the foster care system. On the west side of downtown, overlooking yet another freeway, Thomas New says he's trying to put his past as a bank robber behind him.
I'm 58 years old. I just got done doing 23 years in prison. Right now, I'm kind of like stuck just for a minute until the first of the month, then things are going to start happening for me.
At the beginning of the month, he moves into low-income housing. With so many new encampments right out in the open, it may seem like the situation has never been worse. But in fact, the amount of services and the coordination between service providers has never been better. Joel John Roberts is the CEO at PATH.
The county's working together with the cities. The state and the federal government is funding more programs, and the agencies are working together much better than even 10 years ago.
Over the last couple years, Roberts says the community has housed 17,000 people. There's been an increased emphasis on providing permanent housing, but that shift has cut into funding for beds and temporary shelters.
I think homelessness is not just a social problem, it's a poverty problem. And until this country addresses poverty, we're going to always have homelessness.
Increasingly, the face of poverty includes the recently middle class. 53-year-old Alfred Sierra camps on the bank of the Arroyo Seco Riverbed between downtown Los Angeles and Pasadena. He's sort of an unofficial welcome wagon at the encampment. He advises new arrivals on how to get water and how to protect against thieves. Sierra is seeing more and more economic casualties.
Economy went bad, they lost their job, and then now as the economy comes up, nobody's going to hire them. They're going to get young guys, from 18 to 25. You know? They're going to work for less. Leaves people in between 45 and 60, you know, out in the street.
Outreach professionals, too, report seeing an increase in homeless people between the ages of 40 and early 60s. Some have been sidelined by losing a job or by a health problem. They're part of a gap population, stuck living in tents until they're old enough to qualify for Social Security. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We spent some time talking to some of the people in L.A. who've lost their homes. We've got a video of one man's story up on our website. It's marketplace.org. The video link you're going to be looking for is right up at the top. Coming up, carbon dating the death of World of Warcraft.
That was pretty much when mobile started to enter the market.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 36 points today, about 0.2%, finished at 18,126. The NASDAQ down 8 points, 0.1%, 5,097. The S&P 500 nipped off 2 points, 0.1%. ended things at 21.20. There is, believe it or not, a shortage of lentils. Canada's crop is down because of too much rain. Thus, AGT Food and Ingredients, Canada's biggest lentil exporter, down 1% today, but up 60% from a year ago. The lineage of Silicon Valley chip makers is starting to sound a little bit Old Testament. Here's what I mean. Hewlett-Packard begat Agilent. Agilent begat Avago Technologies. And Avago today agreed to buy Broadcom for $37 billion. Avago up 0.6% after a big jump yesterday. Broadcom down 1.5% today after a bounce yesterday, which is kind of the way the markets work. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the second estimate for first quarter gross domestic product. The University of Michigan issues its final May consumer sentiment survey. And on May 29, 1943, in the midst of World War II, Norman Rockwell's iconic Rosie the Riveter was featured on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a birthday party in Bel Air last night, Bel Air being one of the swankier parts of L.A. Sumner Redstone turned 92 years young, a word I use intentionally because Redstone has more on his plate than most nonagenarians do. He owns majority stakes in and is the chairman of both Viacom and CBS, but age and his increasing reclusiveness are raising some questions about the future of his empire. Bill Cohan writes about Redstone and his life in the current issue of Vanity Fair. Bill, it's good to have you on.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How did Sumner Redstone become Sumner Redstone?
Well, by taking risks that people didn't think he knew how to take or could take successfully, by buying Viacom, the media conglomerate, when nobody expected him to succeed at that, turning around a few years later and buying CBS for a lot of money. He did make some mistakes. He bought Blockbuster Video for about $7 billion and ended up liquidating that. But by and large, through the last 25 years, has been able to get control of both Viacom and CBS, which are two obviously very important media companies.
Les Moonves, the guy who runs CBS, is openly worried about what happens when Sumner Redstone passes away.
Well, and so is Philippe Domon, the CEO of Viacom. I think they're openly worried because they probably don't want their companies to be put in play unless they can control sort of how the denouement of that works out. Sumner is the chairman of both companies. His ownership stake in each company is in this irrevocable trust, which basically kicks in when he dies. There's been some talk that Les Moonves has been trying to buy Sumner's stake in CBS with the help from private equity firms before Sumner passes. That obviously has not really come to fruition yet. Obviously, there's uncertainty regarding these companies when such a big stake could potentially be put in play. But, you know, Rupert Murdoch could come along right now and say, I want to buy CBS, and the board would have to take it seriously.
That would be something to watch. How active is he? He's chairman of the board, right, of Viacom and CBS. How active is he with Les Moonves and Philippe Thoreau at Viacom? Do they talk on the phone every day? Does he send them emails? What does he do? Do you know?
Well, he doesn't use email. He will tell his assistants in New York or Los Angeles how he wants to communicate, and they will either send faxes to Philippe or Les. The Viacom people told me that Sumner is able to make his views known about what he wants Viacom to do. He's especially focused on the Viacom stock price, which has had a rough go of it of late. I think Les Moonves at CBS is probably less in touch with him than Philippe is. But what I'm being told, they would not let me see Sumner. They would not let me visit with him, which, of course, would allow us to understand exactly what's going on, but that he's able to make his views known.
So I'll tell you, I went up to his house about 8 or 10 years ago to interview him. He lives like above Beverly Hills, right? It's up in Beverly Park or whatever it is.
Right.
And you know, the big joke is that he says he's never going to die. The thing is, though, that he actually believes that stuff. I mean, I asked him what happens when he leaves, so to speak, and he all but leaned across the coffee table and strangled me.
And he reiterated that to me in these email answers. But I think last time I checked, no one kind of gets out alive. Sumner may be in a different category. He has been for a long time. The Viacom guys tell me that he's, quote-unquote, as sharp as a tack. Some people dispute that. you know, I think it's possible that for Sumner Redstone, the end might actually be coming, although there's, you know, when that could come, who knows? He's obviously at home. He's doing the things that he's been doing, but I think he's definitely slowing down.
Bill Cohan, he is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. His piece about Sumner Redstone, the 92-year-old Sumner Redstone, is called Endless Sumner. It is in the magazine on newsstands now. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
We've got that interview I did with Redstone back when he was a mere 83, I think. It's on our website, marketplace.org. A moment now for the big business of video games. World of Warcraft has been among the biggest the past decade or so, a veritable juggernaut of massively multiplayer online gaming. Players do battle and go on quests in a fantasy world of gnomes and goblins and elves and orcs, whatever orcs are. And yet, there are some signs that maybe World of Warcraft is showing its age. Jessica Robinson from the Northwest News Network has that story.
As you might expect, finding World of Warcraft players is not too hard. Black Wolf Gamers Club in Spokane Valley, Washington, is full of people sitting in front of flashing screens playing various video games. The words World of Warcraft are barely out of my mouth when the guy behind the counter nods and takes me over to a group of regulars, and one in particular.
Okay. I am Jacob McLaughlin. I am 14 years old, turning 15 in a couple of weeks.
Why did he direct me to you when I was asking about World of
Warcraft? Because I have been playing World of Warcraft for 10 years, and...
Wait, you're 14?
Yeah. I've been playing since I was 4 years old. My grandpa and my cousin actually got me into the game.
Did you catch that? His grandpa. And that should give you an idea of what an institution this game is. World of Warcraft launched in 2004. 2004! That's pretty old in video game years. And it stuck around for one big reason.
It's really addictive.
You know World of Warcraft's nickname? World of Warcrack. Not that it hasn't evolved. Since 2004, the game's publisher has released 5 expansion packs, introducing increasingly visually stunning locations, new quests, bigger, tougher enemies, and at one point, inexplicably, pandas. Well, okay, that was a pretty shrewd nod to the huge Asian gaming market. The game is also incredibly social.
No, left. Go left. Do not touch the
go left, for sure.
Just check out YouTube videos of players teaming up virtually to go on raids against various creatures.
It really does draw you in.
32-year-old James Royce in Billings, Montana, logs on most days. He says other games have tried to knock World of Warcraft off its throne, including a Star Wars subscription game, which you'd think would have a fighting chance because, well, come on, it's Star Wars.
Exactly, and that's the thing, and that's what everybody was really excited about. They're like, oh, yeah, well, everyone's just going to stop playing World of Warcraft because everyone will play Star Wars, and that didn't happen, obviously.
But recently, something has happened. World of Warcraft's parent company, Activision Blizzard, held an investor call earlier this month. And CFO Dennis Durkin said something that made the gaming world sit up and take notice.
We saw a decline in World of Warcraft subscribers. Subscribers ended the quarter at 7.1 million. World of Warcraft's revenue performance...
And that little sentence...
We saw a decline in World of Warcraft subscribers.
...made headlines and started 60-page comment threads in online forums. It amounted to a decline of 3 million subscribers in 3 months.
It actually is a big drop.
Video game industry consultant Wanda Maloney says Blizzard did just release new content for the game, and it's not unusual to see some swift ups and downs when a publisher does that. But Maloney notes World of Warcraft has slowly been losing subscribers since 2010.
And it is an interesting correlation that was pretty much when mobile started to enter the market.
As in, those addictive little games on your phone that are taking larger and larger bites out of the video game industry pie. Activision Blizzard isn't talking, except to point out that World of Warcraft revenue has remained steady, and at the same time, Blizzard has, quote, expanded their portfolio. But longtime World of Warcraft players say it's not just about competition from mobile. They say they've run out of challenges. Blizzard plans to release more new content for World of Warcraft this year, but some players are frustrated it won't be enough. To be clear, World of Warcraft isn't going away anytime soon with its 7 million players.
It is said,
that wars are.
But here's a twist. Remember Jacob McLaughlin, who's been playing since he was four?
I'm actually taking a break right now.
Yep, McLaughlin just stopped his subscription. He says one of the things that made World of Warcraft so addictive was the group of friends he played with. And a lot of those friends have moved on to other games. I'm Jessica Robinson for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a lesson in how not to pitch your business to investors, or perhaps exactly how to pitch your business to investors. Anthony Bourdain, of all those travel and eating shows that aren't really about eating at all, has invested in a startup called Roads and Kingdoms. It's kind of a food and travel website magazine thing. Now, how, you might fairly ask, did somebody as busy as Bourdain come to be an investor in something called Roads and Kingdoms? Because one of the founders of the thing emailed him after drinking, and this is a quote, many glasses of sake, end quote. Kids, don't try this at home. All right, this is going to be tight. Let's see if I can do it. The Dow off 36 points today. The NASDAQ down 8 points. The S&P 500 off 2 points. That's all about 1 or 2/10%. Golda Arthur, Kate Kincannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Schott, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And oh yeah, this is APM.